Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here. We are in Ephesians chapter 6, looking at a new section of verses talking about children and parent relationships. It's one of the basic organizations for mankind. We're going through the home life here. We went through marriage with husbands and wives, and now we're going through parents and children, and then moving into masters and slaves as all part of the home life of the Roman Greek world. Again, this is some basic things, but yet this is something universal. I'll make a couple of statements here. In the world that Paul was writing in, what he's writing here is not radical. It's very basic. The Greeks, the Romans, the Jews all held to the fact that children obey your parents. And it's kind of an astounding thing that we'd think that today, or not that we would think that, but in our world, so many things that have been assumed are being just thrown out. I mean, everything's being flipped upside down. Not like things, but I've said it before, things sometimes seem like they're brand new, but they're just cycling through. It just keeps rotating. But we are doing something in our culture today that I wonder if it's ever been done before, what we're doing with, you know, sex and gender and taking down borders. I mean, there's something, I think, extreme going on. Think of a culture that would actually tear down their borders and bring in foreigners. I don't know if that's ever happened before. I don't know history, but that's a radical. Or what we're doing with sex and gender, how you've got a sex, but you also choose your gender. There's always been homosexuality and transgender and sexual perversion. The Canaanites were filled with it. But what we're doing is very unique. And I don't think, sometimes things surprise me. When I wrote 2007, Hope for America's Last Generation, I put in there, like I've said before, the seven institutions got established, which one was nationalism. I just put it a little paragraph in there, just mentioned it as one of the things, never thinking I was going to have to defend it. I kind of thought it was just general understanding that you have a nation that you're part of, a culture, a country that you're part of, and you support that country. Didn't think you'd have to, you know, almost afraid that people would look at Christianity as being anti-American. And so kind of go out of our way to make sure, no, we as Christians, we support America. We support our country because that's a God-given institution. I never thought we'd have to defend that, you know, your country since you're from a country. Well, the same thing here. I think we're on a very boring subject, especially since I'm a grandparent. My kids are all raised. It's children, raising children. Very important, but I'm just talking about it like it's not controversial. But yet, as I look at it, it's kind of like, well, I didn't think sexuality was controversial. I didn't think nationality was controversial. And here it's going to say, I guess I'm just throwing this up as kind of like a warning. It's kind of like watch for it, not as a prophecy, but just how dumb are we going to get as a culture? Here, this says right here, children, obey your parents. How long is it going to be before our culture is protesting? Parents don't have the right to tell their children what to do. Now, you can think of examples already where the family is being attacked. And, of course, if the family is being attacked, this topic is going to be attacked, where children don't have the responsibility to obey your parents. Who are parents to tell their children what to do? When you start seeing that, and, again, I think you can see it at certain levels, but when it becomes frontline news, I don't know how much further you can go off the deep end before you've hit the bottom. But anyway, this is basic information here, and so I kind of preface that with this because what we're doing here in Ephesians, as you know, Ephesians chapter 5 is, and building up to it, has been comparing the Gentile world, the world of darkness. They've rejected God, they've rejected truth, they've rejected reality, they've gone off and created their own philosophies, their own idol worship. Now compared to us coming to Christ, being delivered from that world, and we've all come from that world. It's not like we're better than they are. We've just been brought into the light, and now God is establishing for us a reality. He's showing us how He's created things, how He's organized, not just, you know, His spiritual revelation, but how He's organized the created world, including society. And this is how we're supposed to live, not in darkness as the Gentiles do, but in light. And we begin in chapter 5, verse 22, talking about husbands and wives. And the key word there is to submit. And submit there does not mean, you know, to come under and be oppressed, but to come in line, to get lined up. You are in this position. You are in this position in the hierarchy of God's creation, starting with God being at top, and then Christ, and then the Spirit, and we go all the way down to the angelic ranks, and then into human society. We talked about husbands and wives and marriage. Now chapter 6, yes, the good news, chapter 6, finally a new chapter in Ephesians. I think this is message 68 of the book of Ephesians, and we're in chapter 6. Now, I know that's there's something wrong there. There's a disorder there somewhere. But nonetheless, chapter 6, verse 1. We're looking at four verses today. I'm reading in the NIV. Coming right along the line of household organization, it says, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you and that you may enjoy long life on the earth." Then there's a little message to the fathers concerning this topic. "Fathers, do not exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord." Then, of course, verse 5 goes on beginning to talk about slaves and masters, and we'll get into that next week, I would assume. Oh, excuse me. Next week. There's no church next week. This building is going to be taken over by a big debate, and so we will not be having church next week. So if I say next week, understand I'm in the moment. I'm not thinking about the calendar. So what we see right here, a very important point, first of all, it says children obey your parents. And again, it's not just mentioning, you know, fathers, but parents as a whole. Even sometimes when it mentions fathers there, some could even see that as being, you know, the father being the head of the marriage. That would include mothers also. Mothers can make these mistakes. But it is interesting here that it is not like the mother is second rate in the parenting. On this, we've got on the notes, I want to read this also, just read through the pages here. You're going to have each of the verses put on here. This is in the English Standard Version. And then underneath there, of course, you've got your Greek and your transliteration. There's a few words that are important here today. And in the English Standard Version, it says, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right." And when we mentioned this is right, I got this sit right up here. The idea that this is right, meaning this is the way it was organized. This is correct. This is, you can almost use the idea of this is holiness. This is the way God designed it to be. You need to obey your parents. There is structure in this. "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right." Then the page 2. And then it begins to quote the fifth commandment. And there we haven't mentioned the five or the ten commandments. This is the fifth one. Several points that we'll mention about this. But the one thing that's interesting is this is the first of the ten commandments, the first one that deals with human relationships. And you can see there on page 2, right in the middle, point 2, I've got the ten commandments written down there. You know, not that you don't know them, but it's easier to just kind of reference them. But number 1, you shall have no other gods. Number 2, you shall make no idols or images. Number 3, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Number 4, you shall keep the Sabbath day holy. And then number 5, honor your father and mother. The first 4 are talking about man and God's relationship. This now enters into the human relationship and the beginning of human relationship, the beginning of human society, the beginning of a solid community is going to be children and parents. Now, you can imagine the chaos. If this is the first commandment dealing with human relationships, you can imagine if you're trying to deconstruct humanity, if you're trying to deconstruct God's order, this is going to be your place of attack. You're going to attack this fifth commandment, but it's the first commandment dealing with human relationships. You're going to attack the family. You're going to attack the children. You're going to attack the marriages. You're going to attack that family unit. Once you break apart that family unit, everything else is going to begin to crumble. You're going to have to figure out what you're going to do with the children, what you're going to do with the separated families. And you just see our culture, part of the chaos that we find ourselves in, is because we've deconstructed this or allowed the deconstruction of the family, the children and the families, and the children are just adrift. And we see it. I don't want to say too much about school because, again, I'm just way at the end of the building. But you can just see, just in a general sense, the direction of schools over from the 1940s to the 1960s to the 1980s to the early 2000s to today, the drift that the school is in and the situations they're having to deal with. And you can say, well, the kids are different, you know, so they've got more technology. There's a million things that you can point and change. But what we have seen consistently over the last, you know, the last 100 years, especially if we look at the 4-generation decline, is the deconstruction of the family, the deconstruction of the father, and putting this in a position where now the children who are being told, obey your fathers and mothers, obey your parents, honor, and that's the beginning of human society, it's it's going to begin to unravel in a way that we can't understand. And these children, they keep coming, generation after generation, year after year. The children keep coming. Parents keep having children. But when there's no home, there's no structure, there's no, as far as fathers are not doing their job, the children, of course, are going to be adrift. And they're going to end up somewhere. And then the thing is, they grow up and they become parents. And you just get further and further and further from the answer until, of course, you get through that. If you go through the fourth generation, there's no way of bringing it back. And so this is, again, it's the fifth commandment. But after one, two, three, four commandments dealing with man and God's relationship, God comes right here with the very first one. He doesn't say the first commandment in human relations, be nice to each other. He doesn't have the first commandment of some other relationship in human structure. He doesn't say obey your government as the first relationship in the commandments. He says honor your father and mother. If you can get this right, if you can get a society that the children honor their father and mother, and the parents will do their job of, as we'll see down here, of nourishing and raising the children, I mean, you're going to be a great culture. You're going to be a great people because the children have parents, the parents have families, and that's the building block of society. And so, of course, this makes sense that this would be the first commandment in human rights. Was God worried about the church nursery being out of control? Was he worried about not being able to organize, you know, a vacation Bible school? No, that was not his thought. His thought was this. Well, I don't know what his thought was. I can't speak for God here. I'm just telling you, the first human relationship commandment is with children obeying their fathers. And again, or obeying their parents. Okay, anyway, that's page 2, and we'll look more at that here in a moment. Then page 3, Ephesians 6, verse 3. They say that to obey your father and mother, and then Paul says also there, this is the first commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you and that you may live long in the land. And so, again, that's, you know, you can debate that, but it's the first very specific promise in, and we'll look at the text. All the commandments, in a sense, have some kind of a promise that, you know, you're going to be blessed, you're going to follow God, you know, the good things there. Even talks about his blessings being with you up to the you know, many thousands of generations as you have no other gods before him. But this is the first commandment with a very specific promise. If you honor your father and mother, it will go well with you, and you will live long in the land. It's going to go well, meaning your life is going to, you can translate that as prosper. Again, and don't think, you know, crazy money, you know, Benny Hinn prosperity. Think it will go well. You will be able to function in society, and life will go well with you, and you'll live long. Now, the difference here is in the Ten Commandments, it says long in the land, speaking of the land of Israel, that the Lord has given you. Paul does make an adjustment here where he changes it from the ideal of the land that the Lord has given you, pulls that out, the phrase, the Lord has given you, and just replaces it with the word that is translated earth. It's the word gamma epsilon in the Greek, but it means earth, land, the land you live in, the territory, the region. He applies it to, you know, now the Gentiles. He's not drawing it back into the Jewish promise. So in other words, again, this is a general principle. God is applying this in the Ten Commandments to his nation of Israel, but it's a general promise, a general principle to all humanity that, you know, before the Ten Commandments, again, we got to keep these things in mind. Before the Ten Commandments were given and Israel was established as the nation, which I think was right around 1440 B.C. People sometimes say 1250 B.C. and that's the debate, but it's right around that time period. But you can realize how many years of history, how many families have come and gone already. So this is not like the beginning of parents. This is not the beginning of families. This is not the beginning of children obeying your parents. It was a principle laid down way back in the beginning of time, and God is just bringing this principle that he's established over all creation and putting it in his constitution, if you would, with Israel, his testimony or his testament with Israel's covenant, and it continues to apply to all humanity. But going on here, that it may go well with you, that you may live long in the land. And then in chapter 6, verse 4, the final verse addresses fathers in this relationship. Children are to obey. And again, this doesn't hinge on the fact that, well, if your fathers and mothers, you know, aren't adequate, then you've got the right to rebel. That's not what we're talking about here. that is the children's responsibility is to obey the fathers. But then the fathers are again tempered by giving them a little bit of advice by Paul. Well, here it is. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. And again, we'll talk about this as we go, but you've got to take this, you're taking this child, this baby, this child, this teenager, this young adult, and you're bringing them up to maturity. There's going to be many teaching moments. There's going to be many defects. There's going to be many failures. And you cannot, and in general sense, you cannot address your child and expect them to be performing at the level of a 20, 30-year-old adult when they're still in the growing phases. And a father who does not understand that can become very, very crushing to a child. Why don't you understand this? I already explained it to you once. Now, you know, I'm going to teach you, or I'm talking about this, but I can just, I mean, I've got images in my mind from years of being a father and of 40 years of teaching children, of just rattling through my mind of examples of me, oops, I didn't do that, oops, I didn't do that, oops, I didn't do that. Because when it talks about that, you have the tendency as a father, especially we talk about, especially our we had six sons, and our older two sons, I've apologized multiple times over the years, sometimes seriously, sometimes jokingly, but it's like the first two times, it's like, I can talk now as a grandfather looking back. But when I was 23, 25, 27, 29, raising these boys, obviously I was sometimes exasperating my children. I was expecting, you're 7 years old and I've already explained this to you. Why don't you understand? And the answer is simple. I'm seven. I don't even comprehend the world the way you comprehend it. I'm going to do it wrong for another 5 years, Dad. Oh, okay. And so my job, you know, again, it's Tyler and, again, Justin, my oldest son, who is Tyler's father. I mean, again, it's a serious conversation. It's also a continuous joke. Is, Tyler, I wished I had a father like you've got a grandfather, Justin would say. Because it's like Justin's father, when he was seven, is a completely different grandfather for Tyler when he's seven. And you think, that's funny. No. It's absolutely true. Justin had a crushing presence in his life of me trying to raise this child with little boys coming behind, and he's like the point man, and Tyler, he's like, in a sense, you know, after six sons, he's my oldest grandson, so he kind of comes in line of seven boys that I'm involved in them growing up, and so my dealings with Tyler are completely like, he'll be fine. It's like, I've seen this six times before. What you see today in Tyler is not what you're going to get in 20 years. Now, again, but there is this level, but there at some point, you just can't say, let them grow like weeds. You've got to be pruning and trimming the whole time. But it's got to be some kind of, well, right here, it's going to be, the words are going to be discipline and admonition. We'll talk about those words. You have to provide discipline, and you have to provide admonition. Meaning it's warnings, and discipline includes training. Meaning you did it wrong. We're going to go back and do it again until you've got this. We're going to train you. So I mean, right here, this is in a sense serious. This is harsh. This is not like, oh, it's just going to be a fun life. This is serious right here. We're correcting, but it's not this. It's not in the sense of provoking or stirring up or overzealous. There's that balance. So again, you can step back and you know what you can deal with. How much can you expect? Again, I'm rambling. But one of the things that I like when I teach shop in seventh grade, I've got like 45 days and I've got about 15 to 18 what we call stations, modules, projects. And what it breaks down to, you can figure it out, 15 times 3 is 45. And it's like clockwork. It's like clockwork. I've introduced... Oh, this project, we're doing soldering kits. Now, I'm talking about kids that are 11, 12 years old. And we've got little soldering kits. You got to put the little components in, and they solder it. I show them the first day, and then they get them out. They do it the second day. They do it the third day. It's fun. Then the next thing we do, I give them some little studs, and we pound little nails and some little boards. We make little walls, little model walls of what, you know, Western-style construction houses is. They do that for about 2 or 3 days. I guarantee you it's like clockwork. After I get done doing the demonstration and I hand out the stuffs, the shop is consumed with children working. I mean, you walk in and go, wow, Weimer's is like the epitome of an educator. You guys are doing real good. And they come ask, Mr. They got a line, ask questions. They're so inquisitive. And I'm just playing loud rock music and watching the children work. I like the loud music because they can't talk. It's like, what? Can't hear you. It's like too loud. So they just have to work. You know, plus it's shop. No matter. And then, you know, the third day, then the projects start getting together. The first kids start getting done and they're excited. But I guarantee you, every time, if we do it a fourth day, if we do it a fourth day, the kids come in a little slower. They get their stuff out a little slower. They've lost more pieces. They're starting to be exasperated. It's like it's not coming together. You've got to help them. They've got some more going to finish the second day. You've got to start helping the kids towards the end of the second day. And by the third day, you've got to start putting this stuff together so everyone, boom, boom, boom. And it sounds fun, and it is fun. But if I've got 125, 130 kids, my goal is that every one of them completes that project. Some of them are going to do it by themselves. Some are going to get confused and lost. Well, they're 12. They're 11. They've never soldered before. They've never took a torch and soldered copper pipe together with a torch. But they're all going to try. They're all going to be excited. Some are going to do it. Some are not. I've got to come alongside, help them complete it. And they're easy. They're easy. They do not remember they were struggling and that you came and finished it. They just, when it's done, it's like, oh, I did it. And it's like they're programmed to forget that you didn't do it. These 5 kids did it. These 20 kids couldn't finish the project. I did it for them. But there, look what I made. And then the next day, now if we do that for the fourth day, you walk in and go, Weimer's can't even control a bunch of 12-year-olds because they're bored. They're doing something. They've already dismissed the project. They've disengaged. They've decided, I'm not going to complete this project. I can't do this. They're not even trying. They still got a torch, but now they're torching something else. I mean, they're soldering. They're pounding nails. I can't get my wall together, but I still got nails and a hammer. They're still pounding nails, but not in the wall. So by the fourth day, we unplug that. We're done. And we move into a, boys and girls, today it's like, we've never done this before. Come over here, I'm going to show you. And all of a sudden, everybody's interested again. New project, new activity, and boom. Weimer's is a great teacher again. I'm standing over here. It's like watching the kids work. It's like clockwork. They've got an attention span. They've got a limit of how much they're going to put. And every kid's a little different on how much. Some kids will just push and push and push themselves. Some kids will dump the stuff out on the table and go, well, they didn't watch the demonstration. You know, so they dump the stuff out on the table. It's like, I don't know how to do this. Well, of course you don't. You weren't even listening to me. How can you? You don't. It's like you. That's why I gave you the demonstration. And I will address that because part of the skill is learning to pay attention to a little demonstration. So I'll chew them out. But, you know, I will do this. I'll admonish them. You know, I will give them some kind of discipline. You know, not like, you know, punish them in any way. But, you know, and after they've endured a little bit of wrath, then I'll help them. And then they'll succeed. And we'll go back and we'll just do it again. Now, the whole point for saying that is I can see very clearly of how, as a classroom teacher, I can provoke kids to anger or exasperate them. If you just put all the stuff out there and say, okay, figure it out. If you were the class, and I gave you the project and said, here, the instructions are on the board. You need to be self-learners. Now, it's time for you to grow up and be responsible for your own education. I've watched people teach like this. I don't say anything because it's like, then no one's going to listen. Well, then you got your one or two or three or four kids that are going to like figure it out. They can read directions. They can figure it out. They can problem. They're gifted in this way, and they'll solve it. You'll say, look at this. These kids did it. Well, the rest of the kids, they don't learn this way. They're going to need someone to come alongside and help them. Maybe they don't have certain experiences, whatever, and they're going to fail. You can say, what's wrong with you? You need to start taking your education years. And after years and years and class, project after project, they come in and they're already disengaged. We say, I've got a project we're all going to do. They're already thinking, no, I'm not. I've never done a project in my life. I've never come. But the other kids, like the success ones, they're going to be like, oh, yeah, I got this. And they're going to get out and accomplish it. My job as a teacher is to not to let that exasperation, that provoke, to set in. So, yeah, there's going to be some kids that you just point at it and they go. I guarantee you there's some kids, my subjects are so simple that if I would give some kids some demonstration, in fact, I've had substitute teachers And I've said, if you don't know what to do, if you can just find a kid that had the class last year, I'll give you a name of three or four kids. They can come in and they could explain it to this year's class. I mean, it's like, they could teach. It's not that hard. You just demonstrate it and answer some questions. So there's going to be kids that will do that, and you let them go. But there's going to be some kids that if you let them run on their own, they're going to be provoked to discouragement, exasperation. That's where you've got to somehow come in without crushing them, provide some kind of discipline, some kind of organization, so they can then be successful, and you can develop this pattern of them coming into shop class, knowing that, hey, we've had 5 projects so far this year. I've got about 10 to go. I've got all of the first 5 have been successful. What are we doing today, Mr. Weimers? Knowing that this is going to be another successful day. Sometimes they can do it themselves. Sometimes I've got to come alongside. Now, if they were 30 years old, if they were shop teachers themselves and they couldn't figure it out, we now have a problem. But if you're 12 and you can't figure out, and it's not like these kids are at home soldering projects or building stuff out of wood or even using 3D printers and Lego robot sets. These are all things we go through. They don't know. This is the first time, even though they think they're the age of technology. I'm not even preaching to you. They think they're the age of technology. The kids are, we are the age of technology. It's like, right, because you can download an app. But you don't, look, here's a 3D printer. I can't figure it out. Of course, because you don't know anything. You can download an app on your phone and send text messages. But I plug you into this computer with a new program you've never seen before. Some are good, just like always, just like soldering, just like woodworking. Some are going to be able to figure it out. Some are going to have to take them by the hand. And you wouldn't believe, and again, you wouldn't believe, there are kids out there that are gifted in woodworking. They're gifted in soldering. They're gifted in reading. They're gifted in math. And those are the kids that rise to the top. But then you got the rest of the children who don't understand the math. You're going to have to walk them through it. They don't understand, you know, the reading. They don't understand the soldering. They don't understand the woodworking. They don't understand the computer. Yeah, right. You're going to have 5 or 6 kids that are just like, ooh, they're computer geniuses. Everybody's like that. No. Just like there's 5 or 6 kids that are good in basketball, the rest of the kids can't even hit the rim. It's like, just because there's 5 or 6 kids that can do jumps and cheerleading, the rest of the kids are going to break their neck. Stop jumping and walk. And so the whole thing is right here. You've got to put these kids in positions without provoking them, providing this. And that's what Paul's saying, but he's talking not to shop teachers. He's talking to parents. So here we go. Let's look at these notes, please, if we can, at the very front of the page, and we'll try to get to this point again. Children. Interesting here, I'm on page 1 of the notes in the English Standard Version with the interlinear underneath it. Children, obey your parents. Notice, children are being addressed. It's not like tell the children, but children are being addressed, and they are told, obey your parents. This is, you know, submit to your parents. One, because that is the way the structure is set up. You are under their authority. And then it says, obey the parents in the Lord, for this is right. They're going to be obeying in the Lord. The Lord is the one who has structured. I don't think this is a disclaimer. I've heard people try to make this a disclaimer. Obey your parents in the Lord. If your parents are not Christians, you don't need to obey them. That's, man, you're running on some very thin territory there. Because that would mean the Greeks, the Romans, the Egyptians, and name all the cultures, they weren't believers, they weren't Christians, and so you don't have to obey your parents. It's like, I think this is a universal statement. Now, again, just like you can't be provoking your children to anger, there's going to come a place where if your parents are like, you know, criminal, illegal, abusive, we got to get these children away. But in the common sense, this is in the Lord means this is the way the Lord established it. We're not talking about Christians. I mean, really, are we talking about believers in the Lord? Are we talking about Christians? Think about Christians that you know. Are there Christians that are flat out losers as parents? It's like, well, yeah, but they're believers in Christ. Right. So we're not talking about are they Christians or are they Gentiles? We're talking about in the Lord, He's established this universe. This is the social order. You've got governments, you've got nations, you've got families, you've got marriage, and now you've got children under parents. In the Lord, He's the one who's established this. And He's established it not just for the church or for Christians or for the Jews. He's established it universal for all ages. This is the way society works on this green planet. So, children, address them, obey your parents in the Lord. They're going to be, if they are in the Lord, they're believers or they're in Christians, or if they're just under the Lord's jurisdiction, which they are. And then it says, for this is right. This is holiness. This is the way it was established. Children need to obey their parents.
I got these points right here. Jewish, Roman, Greek, Holmes would assume the same thing as Paul was writing here. So this is not radical. The Gentiles are not reading this going, what is he talking about? He's just picking them. In fact, here's it says, Stoic philosophers reasoned. Based on their philosophy, they reasoned that son's obedience to his parents, notice parents, not just fathers, but parents, was self-evident and reasonably required by, quote, the nature of things. The Stoic philosophers who didn't recognize Christ, they're from Greece, they recognized by the very nature of the way the world is, sons need to obey their fathers. Or actually, they said parents. So it's general. Again, imagine a culture getting to the place where they decide there's no basis of anything. For example, they could say right here, it's self-evident on the nature of things. We are in a society that is destroying the very concept of, quote, of the nature of things. You can't say of the nature of things because there's no organization, there's no structure. It's all based on what you feel. There's nothing out here. It's what's in here that matters. So eventually, this is going to come under attack in our culture. Because we can't say, like the Stoics, we're not talking about the Christians, we're talking about the Stoic philosophers that was supported by Jews, supported by God's writings, supported by the Apostle Paul. We're going to get to a place in our culture where it's like, no, it's not real clear, it's not obvious, it's not a given that children have to obey their parents. They can choose. Now, we're that's not on the headlines yet, but my gosh, the way we're how stupid we're getting, it's got to be coming. It's got to be coming. The Stoic philosophy, okay, Nick, similar to Colossians, okay, here, right, Colossians, we'll refer to this several times, say Colossians 3, verses 20 and 21. It's Colossians and Ephesians are what we'd say sister letters. They're written from the same prison cell, or not prison cell, under house arrest in an apartment, but they're written from the same place in Rome by Paul about the same time and sent to the same area in Asia Minor. Paul writes in a very same structured letter, he writes, children, obey your parents in everything, for this pleases the Lord. See how it pleases the Lord because it's the Lord's structure, and obey them in everything. And then he says, fathers, do not provoke your children, lest they become discouraged. So he, instead of having four verses, he's got just two, mentions nothing about the fifth commandment. So you can see right there, just keep that in mind. This is repeated in Colossians. So everything I say, and how do we interpret Ephesians 6, 1 through 4, you can come over and get some insight. Paul's not going to contradict himself in those two verses, so you may be able to see if I had it set it in the wrong direction and it's contradicted in Colossians, then I went the wrong direction with it. They should be parallel, although they're talking about it, maybe using some different words. Note the continuation of the line of authority. We talked about that. This section is addressed to children, referring to lifetime. Okay, oh yeah, point six. This referring to a lifetime relationship. But obviously the child in training will be treated differently than an adult child. So there's no time limit on this. Children, honor your parents, for this is right in the Lord. That's going to be a lifetime thing, but obviously when you become an adult, you're not in the same training mode as you are, but there should still be that honor and respect, as it was in all cultures. Next page. Somewhere I wrote down, here's what I'm thinking on page 3. Go to page 3 at the bottom. I kept thinking I was going to bump into these notes here as I was reading, and I wasn't. But here, you're talking about a father. On point 1, fathers are to discipline and admonish with sensitivity and moderation. That's kind of what's being said there. But now, the Greek writers wrote this. Meander wrote, there's three things here. This is coming out of the Greek writings. A father who is always threatening does not receive much reverence. Another thing Meander wrote, these are Greeks. One should correct a child by not hurting him, but persuading him. That doesn't mean you have to sit down and, reason with a 2-year-old. Again, I don't think that's possible. But it does mean instead of forcing them, it'd be nice if you could somehow teach them. That's what you're seeing right here. There's a place to force. There's a place to discipline, especially, and again, I don't want to get redundant here. Here's what we kind of used, and you can be critical of this, what we kind of used is between the ages of 2 and 12, you are in a control mode. And again, meaning a 2-year-old, this, again, please forgive me if this offends you or you disagree with this, but this is how I operate. And I think it's biblical. Then you got 12 to say, you know, 18, and then you're now, let's say, adult, whatever. And so what I'm talking about right here is a child will never lose that parent relationship. They've got to be honor them. But a parent's going to treat a child in these ages different than, and in a progression, meaning it's different. Obviously, 7 is different than 2, and 12 is different than 7. But in 2, you're basically in control mode. There is basically zero choice. It's like you don't choose anything unless it's on a very frivolous manner. You're wanting to play with them, have fun with them, but you tell them when to eat, you tell them when to sleep, you show them what they're going to eat, and if you want to give them a choice of what color cup they want to have. Now, you know, I don't want to get extreme on this, but I see people trying to reason. I have a hard time sometimes reasoning with 12-year-olds at school. You can, but it's going to be easier to reason with a 16-year-old than a 12-year-old, and you've got more in common logically with an 18-year-old than you do a 7-year-old. How are you going to reason with a 2-year-old? This is exactly right. This is provoking. You're provoking your child to anger when you sit down with a 2-year-old and try and reason with them. Just like my child in shop is soldering the solder kit for the first time, and they've had fun melting some solder, and now the things are going in backward, and it's now sticking together. It's like they're getting frustrated. Why? Because I'm asking them to do this. Now, this kid over here just did it. He's did it. That's because they're different skill sets. This kid's getting frustrated. My job is not to come over and say, well, you know, and then begin to correct or discipline them or call them losers. Now, if they're screwing around, I'll definitely call them a loser. But if they're just struggling with this kit, my job is to somehow magically push this kid into the junk, get out a brand new kit, start putting together, and have them so I can avoid the 2-year-old scenario where I'm asking a 2-year-old to do something that only a 12 or an 18-year-old can do. And so these modern philosophized parents or teachers who are trying to reason and give the 2-year-old choices, you're not just frustrating yourself. You're putting this kid, you're taking this kid's mind. He can't handle it. And so you basically right here are in control mode. 2 through 12, very few choices. And again, every year they get more and more choices. You can watch me on Facebook play with Tyler, and Tyler does a lot of free things and fun things. But at the end of the little Facebook post, there's a grandpa there that's like saying, we're in this box right here. He's jumping around having fun. It's like, yeah, but grandpa's right outside her saying, you don't come out of that box, son. And so it's like, oh, look, Tyler's doing so many fun things. He's 7. He'll have more than 8 by the time he's 12, you know, and I'm not his father, and, you know, we talk about that too, because I can slip into father mode. Even with my kids at school, I can go into father mode real quick. And then you got a father calling you because you went into father mode. There's a very fine line there. But understand, this place right here is control mode. 12 to 18, this is where you start. They've got to start making decisions. And one of the problems, now you're going to push this too far. Let's push this too far. Let's go with some extreme religious, Christian religious group. And we've been on our pendulum, believe me, we've been on our pendulum. You take this 2 to 18, we're in control. I'm stinking in charge of these kids. They're my kids, they'll do what I want, they live in my house. Now, there's a truth. You live in my house, you do what I want. All the boys learn that lesson. Even when you're 18, you come home from college and you're 20, live in my house. There's still some rules you're going to follow. That's one good reason why you find your own place, son, because this is my house. But that's another whole topic. But eventually, you've got to step away from control mode right around these years and start letting them make decisions under your supervision, where now you can begin reasoning with them. As the older they get, depending on the child, the more you can be logical and let them reason. Let them make some choices. I want to do this. I want to do that. Okay. I don't want to play this sport. I don't want to, you know, maybe in classes. I went with this. Dad, it's a C. I'm passing the class. It's good enough. I mean, you're not going to do this for a career. Just get a C. So they've got to get A's. Well, okay, if that's what you want. But my theory was there's something you got to pick and choose. Some things you want to be a C student in. You don't want to pour your life into a bunch of classes that all you're trying to do is please the teacher. Get your C and move on. Now, again, what are the consequences of it? In many cases, there are no consequences of getting a C. I taught my kids that. Mediocrity, I taught my kids. Boy, I'm not like some kind of parent from God up here talking. I don't mean to be that way. But I did teach my kids here. Mediocrity is underrated. Meaning, pick and choose your battles. What do you want to excel in? Go after it. Set your goals. Then all these other goals that people throw at you, put them in the category B. I'll get a C. Why don't you could get an A in this? I know, but I don't want an A. I want a C so I can pass the class because I'm up here. I'm working on this. So there's a place of taking this, and it's a fallacy, I think. You got to be excellent in everything. Excellent in everything. You're going to go insane. You understand how many things are coming at you in life? Some things you're just going to have to take the generic off the shelf and go with it. It's like, which is the best product? I don't know. I'm going to use, imagine, and some people will, research every product they buy in the store. It's like, come on. It's like, I like this one. It's good enough. Now, if you see a warning label causes cancer, maybe get a different one. But it's like, you can't, and then your yard. You want to mow your yard? You want a green yard? How far you got to keep the weeds cut down? Just, you know, put gravel in. You want a green yard or not? I don't even want a green yard. Well, then put gravel in. You don't have to mow it. Just spray some weed killer on it. Well, yeah, but what about the other? What do you want in life? And so right in here, that's when they start making these decisions. And what's nice about letting them make some decisions right here is when they make a decision and fall, they fail in our culture, in my house, guess where they're at? They're in my house. They failed under my supervision, which means now I can come and I can provide this. I can provide the admonition. I can provide the discipline without provoking them. You're not a loser. You just made a bad decision. Let me tell you, I had sons that would, you know, I could tell you all kinds of stories. Dad, the kids are picking on me at school. Well, stop acting like an idiot. What did you do? Well, I was saying this. Well, stop. It's like, I can't even say this out loud. But it's like, if you stop acting like a dork, they'll stop. They're picking on you because they want you to stop acting like that. Now, again, if there's some kind of bullying going on, inappropriate bullying, that's another thing. But if people are just socially, believe me, I know this. I know social rejection. Why are they rejecting me? Because you're not acting very social. It's kind of a part of the teaching mechanism. So these kids come home. The kids are picking on me. My job, well, you decide. There's a place to call the school. My kid's getting beat up on the bus every night or whatever. There's a place to call and intervene. There's also a place to talk to your kid before you call the principal, the teacher, all the parents and send out a newsletter. It's like, tell your kid, why are they picking on you? Well, I said this. Well, let's think about it. Do you think that's offensive? Do you think that's stupid? Do you think that's insulting? Do you think that's cool? What would you think of a kid that said that? Well, they got to put up with me the way I like. No, you need to socially adjust to your culture. I apologize for having gone here with all this, but this for me, this all comes out of this for me. As I read these verses, what do they mean? Is you do not want to provoke your child where they get discouraged, they give up. But you can't just not discipline or train them. There's a fine line. And I think Paul's addressing this, and we're going to have to finish this in 2 weeks. And that's sad, I guess. I thought we'd be just flying through this. But I would like to take these words and probably next week spend more time on these words. I showed them here, provoke. It means, provoke is a Greek word from two words. It means close and become angry. I mean, you're close, like parapaleto or paraclete, where you're close. I'll send you the comforter, the counselor, the paraclete. That means close by, the one that comes beside. This means close by, but to become angry. Instead of the paraclete, you're coming beside somebody and encouraging them, like Jesus said, I'll send the Holy Spirit. The Father becomes beside them and make them angry. In other words, you're right there in their life. You're up in their grill, but you're making them angry. You're not disciplining them. You're not admonishing them. You're not teaching them. You're just provoking them. You're making them angry. You're so close to them, you're making them angry. Or Colossians says the same thing. It's translated the same way in the English, but it's a different word. It means to stir up. You stir up their anger. Here you're close to them, and so you're like making them angry because you're not the comforter or the counselor. You're the one that comes beside them and makes them angry. This is, right here, is you're stirring up. It's like there's stuff inside of them, and you're the one, instead of calming it down or organize, there's confusion in them, and you need to organize it. Maybe you need to counsel them. Maybe you need to discipline, bring some order. Maybe you need to shut down the 2, 3, 4-year-old, shut it down and say, you're going to sit here, you're going to sleep here, you're going to eat this. You've organized it there. You've taken the anger and put it at peace because what else are you going to do? I'm going to eat this. I'm going to sleep here. I'm going to play here. Okay, and they learn to enjoy that. But to not do that would be to do this very thing right here. You're stirring it up. Where do you want to sleep? What do you want to eat? What do you want to wear? It's like, I changed my mind. It's like, and now the parent's frustrated because the anger has been stirred up. And again, it's different at every age as you go through this. And ultimately, they're going to be an adult. So I want to look at those words some more this week. The good news is here, if you can pull this off, it will go well, and they'll live long. And imagine not being able to do this, things will not go well. If it doesn't go well as a 2-year-old, 7-year-old, 12-year-old, 18-year-old, and now they go off into adult life and it's never gone well, they've never learned some things, now they're going to go off into the society that the society is founded on the family. And if you do not do a good job of preparing these people, they're going to go off into a society that's assuming, the society God structured assumes that there's been a family that raised the children with some kind of discipline, some kind of education, they're not angry. They know how to manage themselves now in this level. You've prepared them for this level. And then when they go out and they're not prepared, they don't know what's wrong. And now it doesn't go well for them. Nothing works. I mean, like we've said before, if they can't listen to you as a parent, now they're going to play on the high school football team or they're going to play on in the band. It's like, if they can't listen to the parents, sometimes the coaches or the teacher be the first ones. I know this. Sometimes the first person that engages this kind of relationship is in the classroom. And now they're 5, 7, 12 years old, 17. Oh, my gosh. And just help. I mean, that's the thing. So, will not go well, and they'll live long. Can you imagine? If they can't handle it, it will not go well. And you can translate that word prosper, but it doesn't mean filthy rich. It means you will succeed at your job at McDonald's. You'll succeed your first year in college. You'll succeed when you get married because you can have a relationship. You'll succeed and keep just building your life. It will go well with you. And because things are going well, you'll be able to live long. You'll have a long life. That's just in the natural. Now you take that and combine it with the fact that it's a promise of God, and now He's supernaturally blessing you, and His Spirit and His presence is with you. Now look at Joseph. Look at Daniel. God was with them, and they did well. They lived long. So again, there's that supernatural side of this. We're talking practically, because a lot of people just dismiss the practical. Say, well, we're Christians, so it's going to go well. They're going to live long in the land because God's going to bless them. That's assuming you've nailed this. God's blessing is always available. But if you can do the natural, God can add to that spiritual blessing. I'll pray and we'll clean this up next week.